Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to New Books in History, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Mark Clovis, your host for the channel. Today I'm talking with Robert Childs about his examination of the presidential campaign of Al Smith, entitled The Revolution of 28, Al Smith, American Progressivism, and the Coming of the New Deal. Rob, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me, Mark.
Well, thanks for agreeing to speak with us about your book. I was wondering if you could start us off, though, before we get to the book, by telling us a little bit about yourself.
Well, sure. I actually came to history in a sort of roundabout way. As an undergrad, I was going to be a music teacher. My undergrad degree is in music. But along the way, I sort of remembered my childhood love for history, taking a few really good classes, decided to pursue a master's in history, and sort of just fell in love with it and kept going. And now I'm a historian.
And you've chosen political history instead of, say, music history or cultural history. It's a very interesting choice. What led you to political history as a area of interest?
Well, I always think political history, especially these days, gets kind of a bad rap. People think of it as sort of top-heavy and top-down and old-fashioned. And in fact, I think it's precisely the opposite. What I like about political history is that if it's done well, it's a very holistic view of American life, and I do U.S. political history. If you're going to understand politics, what is politics but the way that institutions and parties and whatever you want to call the system tries to interact with all the many diverse things going on in a society at any given time? So if you're going to do good political history, you also have to master cultural and economic and social and technological and all the other kinds of histories that are going on. And so I kind of take a much broader view of it. And to me, that's a nice way to look at the society more, as I said, more holistically.
And I was thinking your book is a good reflection of that approach, because while Al Smith is at center stage throughout your book, you're not just talking about it as Al Smith as a politician, Al Smith as a governor, but you also talk about the voters and how they responded and their engagement with it. So you're not just doing top-down, you're also doing bottom-up and showing the interplay between the two.
Yeah, well, I'm glad that you felt that way. That was really my goal, especially in trying to understand why voters responded to Smith the way that I argue they did. You really have to understand their lives and their suffering and their pain and their hopes and dreams and so forth. And so I'm glad that that came through in the book.
What led you to focus on Al Smith and his 1928 presidential campaign in particular as a book subject?
Well, it's actually a really, I think it's kind of a funny story. I'm from Baltimore, but my wife is from Long Island. And when we were dating, we would go up to visit her father, and I saw these things named after Robert Moses. and I wanted to find out who in the heck Robert Moses was. So, of course, I read The Power Broker by Robert Caro, and 2,000 pages later, I was very aware of who Robert Moses was. But also, in the early chapters, of course, those who are listening who know Robert Moses know his early career is very much wrapped up with Al Smith's governorship. And so I became fascinated with this character, Al Smith, who I had sort of noticed along the way once in a while in high school history and so forth, but never felt satisfied I knew enough about him. And so for my first grad research paper, I started looking into Al Smith's governorship, and I became, I guess you could say, fascinated, consumed by his reforms and the complexity of what he was doing. And next thing you know, there's a dissertation, and beyond that, a book. So that's how I got into this.
Al Smith is a figure who is, if you know, to the degree he's known today, is typically known as he was the first Catholic nominated for a major political party. This was being in 1928, and that this has shaped a lot of our understanding of him. And yet, when you start your book, you point out the degree to which that really is a misunderstanding of Al Smith, his campaign, and his legacy to American history.
Well, I think that's right. I mean, on the one hand, there's absolutely no denying the profound importance of the fact that he was a Catholic and that he was the first Catholic running. And that definitely shaped much of the campaign and of his career. And it is an important part of his legacy and something that's honorable, the way in which he handled that in public life and some of the terrible things that were said about him as a result of that. It's all very important. And so to a certain extent, the mythology around him is grounded in fact. But the problem is that it tends to distract us from the very serious policy initiatives that he enacted as governor, and that he championed as a presidential candidate, and that were, I would argue, the other half of his very real appeal to millions of Americans who were, yes, ethnically and religiously marginalized, but also economically suffering in the 1920s. And so while the religious question is fundamentally important, it's not the whole story. And so I've tried to correct that in this book.
You begin the book by talking about how Smith came to his progressive politics. And I was wondering if you could elaborate upon how it was he goes from, you know, this childhood, this early involvement with Tammany Hall in at the beginning of the 20th century, to becoming a champion of a series of reforms that you wouldn't necessarily associate with of someone with his, you know, early background in politics.
It is, to me, a very important part of this story, because first of all, it shows the profound significance of women from especially the Settlement House tradition, but in general, the sort of progressive women that are only in the last generation or so getting the kind of credit they deserve for being so central to progressivism in the late 19th and early 20th century in this country. And this was certainly the case for Smith. He had been kind of, to put it, I guess, as bluntly, as a legislator early on, he was kind of a party hack. I mean, he was sent there by Tammany because he played by the rules, and he didn't give a single speech in his first term as a state legislator. However, he was tenacious, and he tried to learn about how state government worked. And so right away, he became sort of a self-taught expert on the mechanics of state government. And that later on allowed him to be a progressive reformer when it came to sort of technocratic reforms. But more important than that was his interaction, as I said, with progressive settlement house and social reform women, women from the labor movement, women from settlement houses and so forth, who, especially in the wake of the horrendous Triangle Fire in March of 1911, and you know, the state started doing all these investigations, and Smith and his best friend, state senator at the time, Robert Wagner, were leading the investigations. They called in these experts, and the experts on factory conditions in New York tended to be women from that tradition. And so they start to educate these women. These women start to educate Smith and Wagner and really teach them about the real horrors going on in factory life in New York State and around the country in the early 20th century. And through that interaction, they became even more interested in a broader, not just labor reforms, but social welfare reforms in general. And this helped people like Smith and Wagner and others, but especially Smith. It helped them to understand that they could use the power they had accumulated through Tammany Hall and through sort of old school partisan politics. They could use that power not just to stay in power and win elections, but also to help people from impoverished backgrounds like Smith had grown up. And I mean, he grew up poor. His father died when he was in eighth grade, and he had to drop out of school and work 12-hour days. And it's a really inspiring story. But what he realized as a politician was he could use his power in the government to make life easier for people from his neighborhood, from that background. And so that was sort of his odyssey, especially in the 1910s. And it culminated with his election to governor of the Empire State in 1918.
One of the things you delve into when you're talking about that process, though, that I thought was especially interesting, was the degree to which it was not just these settlement house workers like Lillian Weld and Francis Perkins who are educating Al Smith, but that he is also, in a sense, helping to show them how to achieve their goals within the existing political process. I was thinking in particular, just one example, of when he has that conversation with Frances Perkins, and she's explaining how she is an independent, and he's saying to her, well, if you want to get something done, you have to join a party and, you know, work through that. And that, you know, begins this process of Frances Perkins eventually becoming Secretary of Labor in the 1930s and establishing not just the statewide legacy that she does thanks to her connection with Al Smith, but her national legacy later on.
Oh, absolutely. And I'm glad that you picked up on and brought up that point, because it's really that conversation and the relationship that was built between Smith and Perkins out of that and a series of other related conversations really changed the course of American history. As you point out, she becomes first female cabinet secretary under FDR, and recent scholarship has finally given her her due as one of the great architects of New Deal reforms. But in the meantime, you're right, women reformers, they'd always been involved in politics. It would be silly to say that what they were doing, trying to change local government, trying to call for reforms, lobbying and so forth, wasn't clearly political. It was. But there's a difference when you cross a new threshold to partisan politics, right? They had tended to be, and of course there are always exceptions, and historians have noted some of the women who earlier on had been engaged in partisan politics. But in general, these reformist women tended to be trying either to be part of nonpartisan movements. They certainly were against the political machines, namely Tammany, but machines all over the country. And many of them, when they were invited to attend political party conventions, for example, they attended out of interest, but not out of enthusiasm for the parties. After all, women in most of the United States still couldn't vote in the 1910s. Out in the West, many women could. But in New York State, for example, women could not vote until 1917. And nationally, there were many places where it wasn't until 1920. And so Frances Perkins points out in her memoirs, well, I didn't have to be a member of any party because women didn't have the vote, so it was irrelevant. I was there. I was watching politics because I was interested, but not because I was a partisan. And Lillian Wald went even further when the Democrats in 1912 solicited her support. She told them that it would be hypocritical for her, as someone who supported women's suffrage, to support a party that wasn't willing to do that. And so as things are changing in the late 1910s, Al Smith had to sort of and some of his allies, but especially Al Smith himself, had to sort of take the lead behind the scenes in convincing these women that partisanship was worthwhile. And you brought up his main point, which is being independent might make you feel pure, and it might make you, cleaner than the partisan, especially the machine politicians, but you can get more done when you have a big coalition around you and people who are supporting you politically, and that would was the argument that he made, and made successfully with Francis Perkins, and eventually with Lillian Wald as well.
You situate Al Smith in that respect as, part of this Tammany machine that produces results, and yet even when he's elected governor, as you explain, he is not able to just push through a progressive agenda in 1919 or 1920, that in fact he encounters significant headwinds. I was wondering if you could explain a bit as to what it was he initially sought to do as governor that fits within this progressive mold, and where was the opposition coming from, and why was he facing this opposition?
That's a great question. So when he first came in, the timing was just right for what we would label as a progressive agenda, because he took the oath of office January 1919, and we're just coming out of World War One, and World War One had exposed all sorts of public health and housing and other kinds of social welfare crises in New York State and across the country, and so it was potentially an opportunity as governor to have all sorts of reforms growing out of the obvious needs for reform, things like improving state investments in affordable housing, especially in the New York metro area, things like improving state investments in public health. There was a large percentage of draft age men who were simply ineligible to fight because they were physically not up to it in New York State. And this was an embarrassment to the state. And so his agenda, they called it the Reconstruction Commission. He brought in all sorts of reformers. The person that he basically had as, in the words of her biographer, the linchpin of this commission was Belle Moskowitz, another of these progressive women who became really Smith's foremost advisor. And so she's basically running that Reconstruction Commission for Smith. And they came up with all sorts of suggestions, sweeping social welfare reforms to New York State, everything from compulsory health insurance program for industrial workers to improved benefits for widows of industrial accidents and improved workmen's compensation and investment in housing and investment in recreation and public milk commission to make sure that healthy, clean milk was available and all sorts of other things. And you point out correctly that his first term was not fruitful really at all. You ask why, and the main reasons, there's a couple. Number one, as in the entire time Smith was governor of New York, he did not have Democratic majorities in the state legislature. Occasionally, he would have a Democratic majority in one house or the other, there was always at least one Republican house of the legislature, and usually both, throughout the entire four terms of Smith's governorship. And the other problem was the Red Scare. It was very easy for conservative opponents of Smith's agenda to caricature, for example, compulsory health insurance for industrial workers in New York as Bolshevism. And so things that started to have momentum ended up running into either partisan opposition or Red Scare atmospherics. And then in 1920, he was not reelected. Fortunately for him, he was able to make a comeback. But 1920 was a terrible year for Democrats, and he got voted out of office as part of the national Harding landslide in 1920.
One of the interesting things about his success in returning to office after 1922 is that some politicians might have taken that as a message to perhaps trim their sails, to avoid the controversies that they might have perceived as being the reason why they had lost the previous time. And yet, as you explain, when Smith comes back, he jumps right back into this. And you describe how he pursues these campaigns. He also takes up another one that, for me, was a real revelation, which was his involvement in conservation. It's not something you think about with Al Smith and his agenda. And yet you talk about this, and I thought it was a nice microcosm of his efforts to both pursue progressive reforms, but also how he had to do so within this existing political structure, which was not always favorable to him.
No, that's absolutely right. And I agree with you that conservation is a fascinating example. First of all, because as you sort of implied with your question, we think of him as this urban character, and you don't think of conservation as one of his priorities. But in fact, it really is emblematic of his broader notion that you can use the state government affirmatively to improve the lives of people. And that could mean creating parks and beaches on Long Island that had access to urban populations, but it could also mean protecting larger sections of the Adirondacks from timber cutting or from hydroelectric development. And in his words, this was because he had this vision that over generations we're going to need that, and this is something the state can do for its people now and in the future. And you're also right that he had to use the mechanics of state government very shrewdly in order to accomplish these things. The example in conservation, of course, is how are you going to pay for the land acquisitions? And so he had to go to the people and campaign actively in 1924 to get a bond initiative just to get some of these parks. And when that wasn't enough money in 1925, he had to go for a much larger bond. And they had to create sort of regional park commissions, and over time they were going to realize that this and many other issues were burdening an antiquated structure of the state government. So they actually had to streamline and reform the entire structure of New York state government so that you couldn't just it's one thing to have good ideas and even have money for it, but you also want to be able to deliver these services, whatever they may be, efficiently. And so all of these things sort of built one after another in his second, third, and fourth terms after his comeback and created this really holistic progressive agenda for New York State, much of which, not all of it, but much of which he was able to institute over that period.
Another aspect of it that I thought was very interesting was, and this gets to how the political environment back then was different than it is today, which was his success in reaching out not just to independents, but to Republicans, in particular, progressive Republicans. And the name that stood out for me was, of course, Charles Evans Hughes, former governor. He had been a Supreme Court justice. He had been the Republican presidential nominee in 1916. And how when he was undertaking that streamlining effort, he reaches out to Hughes and other progressives in the Republican Party. And in effect, does not allow the fact that the Republicans control parts of the process to necessarily serve as an obstacle to getting things done.
Yeah, it's a really interesting point. My students often have trouble deciphering the politics of the early 20th century for the very fact you pointed out. It's so different from today. The two parties within themselves had very strong progressive wings in each party, and they also had very strong conservative or stand pat wings within the parties. And the Republicans in New York are a fascinating example of that. Many of the nationally inclined New York State Republicans had progressive inclinations, whether that had been Teddy Roosevelt earlier or whether it was now Charles Evans Hughes. And even the ones who weren't especially progressive still had reformist ideas. So Elihu Root is another good example. He was not, you wouldn't call him a progressive, but he was reformist, and he also had much more national views than local. Whereas the state party in New York tended to be highly from the old guard, very much more of a conservative party. And so Smith was able to use the legacies and ideas and eventually the individuals from the more progressive wing of Republicanism in New York State to his advantage. He was willing to work with these people behind the scenes, and eventually they were able to persuade Hughes. And there was no denying Hughes's Republican bona fides. that once he got him on board, then it really was helpful in sort of blunting the Republicans in New York, their attempt to basically kill his streamlining of state government. And Hughes did this reluctantly. It's really an interesting story. Root and some of the other, Henry Stimson's another one, some of the other New York Republicans had been working with Smith for a while, but the crown jewel of this fight was getting Hughes involved. And once they brought him in, there was really nothing that the state party could say, because, as I said, he had been in, and as you pointed out, he had been in every position that you mentioned. You know, he had been governor. He wasn't very popular with Republicans in New York, even when he was governor. It's been argued by one Hughes biographer, the only way he got renominated in 1908 was by Theodore Roosevelt's intervention. His progressivism was obnoxious to a lot of New York Republicans, even during his own term, but he was still this highly credentialed. He had run against Wilson. He had been Harding's Secretary of State. So there was no questioning his resume. And once he got involved, it really achieved basically everything that Smith had hoped for, as far as making state government much more efficient, slightly less expensive, although those results never really materialized the way they had hoped, but also just a lot more effective.
This episode is brought to you by ShipStation. If you run an e-commerce business, you know how much work it takes to produce something great while dealing with complicated shipping issues. That's why over 130,000 companies have turned to ShipStation, an innovative tool that allows you to focus less on shipping and more on building your brand. With ShipStation, you can manage orders, label printing, reporting, and customer service on one easy-to-use dashboard. You'll reduce warehouse costs with reliable enterprise solutions and save thousands on shipping costs with discounts up to 89% off. Plus, you can effortlessly import orders from everywhere you sell online. So, turn your shipping challenges into opportunities for growth. Go to ShipStation.com and use code POD to sign up for your free 60-day trial. That's ShipStation.com, code POD.
To what degree does his progressive advocacy play a role in his emergence as a potential presidential candidate over the course of the 1920s?
That's a very important question. I'm glad you asked it that way, because, again, the famous story for sort of Smith's turning point to being a national candidate is the 1924 convention. And the 1924 convention at Madison Square Garden is... it's fraught with all the culture wars issues of the 20s. It's the Southern Democrats against the Northeastern Machine Democrats. It's Smith against William Gibbs McAdoo, who, as your listeners probably know, had been Wilson's Treasury Secretary and son-in-law, and now was a political ally of basically of the Southern and Western interests, and of the Klan for that matter, and was seen as the presidential front-runner. And so as Smith's emerging as this national figure in 1924, it's on behalf of Northeastern and Midwestern machine Democrats who are trying to stop McAdoo and promote Al Smith as an alternative that represents sort of the new Americans and those who oppose prohibition and who oppose the Klan. 1924 is also famous because the Democrats are debating whether or not to have a plank in their platform denouncing the Ku Klux Klan by name. And shockingly to us today, that actually failed. They weren't even able to do that. And so for all of those reasons, the traditional answer to your question would be it wasn't about his progressivism, it was because of these culture wars. But actually, even in 1924, when Smith was instructing his allies, you know, what should we focus on during this campaign, he talked about his gubernatorial record. And when he gave a speech to the convention, which I should mention was held at Madison Square Garden, so he had a bit of a strategic advantage there, he talked about some of the things we've just been talking about, some of these social welfare and administrative reforms in New York State. And then coming out of 1924, And this, I think, is a way to answer your question with more nuance. After 1924, when the Democrats got rocked all around the country and Coolidge was reelected in a landslide, Al Smith got reelected in New York anyway. Even though back then New York leaned Republican, Al Smith got reelected in 24 despite those headwinds. And as he sort of reasserted himself on the national scene, his first major speech after 1924 was out in Chicago. I think it was in the spring, but it was in 1925. And the Cook County Democratic Party turned out 100,000 people. The machines were really good at getting a crowd there. And he spoke about administrative reform. And he spoke about industrial protections and widows' pensions. He did not talk, the newspaper accounts of it sort of remark, he didn't mention his well-known opposition to prohibition. So it wasn't on the cultural issues that he was making, that he was pushing himself as a national candidate. It was instead on a progressive resume in New York State, of which he was very proud. He did the same thing the following year. He went to Philadelphia and he gave a well-received speech. And in this case, it was about using bonds to build hospitals, which he had done successfully in New York State, in which he was encouraging Pennsylvanians to do as well. And so he really, it would be foolish to argue that the cultural issues didn't matter. And I don't mean to ever suggest that, but those were one side of him. And as he was emerging as a national candidate, he usually emphasized the social welfare and labor reforms and administrative reforms that he had accomplished to a large degree of success in New York State.
That actually gets to a point that is not necessarily central to your book, but is an important part of it, which is that to think of these voters in these cities, in particular these ethnic voters, the Italians, the Poles, and so forth, as being automatic Democrats at this point is a falsehood. And it's the flip side of what you're talking about in terms of how we think about politics back in the 1920s versus how we sometimes perceive them as today, is that you're talking about a group that in which their allegiances were fluid. You point out later in the book that in the 1920s, they were voting Republican as often as they were Democrat. Chicago, the example you cited, in the 1920s had a Republican mayor. And so to simply say that they were drawn to him because he happened to have been from the city, because he happened to have had this Irish identity, points to how their allegiances had to be courted, and that you emphasize how, as you were pointing out, that his advocacy of these reforms, his proposal, this progressive agenda, is so central to that.
Absolutely, and it's not a central part of my argument, but it is a fundamentally important part of my argument. We can't take for granted that these voters were going to be or become Democrats. The Democratic Party had done a horrible job of courting them, even in the tail end of the Wilson years. And certainly, I mean, in 1920, you have the famous speech where the Democratic nominee, James Cox, denounced hyphenated Americans. And then in 1924, the Democrats, as I mentioned earlier, couldn't even denounce the Klan by name. The Democrats were still seen largely as the party of the South, and of to a lesser extent, it's still hanging around. He's still hanging around Bryanism, and things that didn't really appeal to a lot of those new Americans in the factories and in the Northeast and Midwest. And in fact, one of the reasons I spend so much time in New England is because that's where we see some of the most dramatic changes. The French Canadian workers in New England were largely Republican. Italians were trending Republican by this time. They had been at other times sometimes Democratic. Most of the elite members of these communities were Republican more often than not. That went especially for French Canadians, but also Polish voters. The Jewish vote nationally was often sort of down the middle. It wasn't overwhelmingly one way or another. And also, you know, workers in general, irrespective of ethnicity, had tended to be Republican since William McKinley. It's the full dinner pail. All of those factors and skepticism toward the Democratic Party because of its rural and southern reputation, skepticism in the Northeast by groups who weren't Irish, the other ethnic groups. The other funny thing is in New England and in other parts of the Northeast, some of the new immigrant groups actually resented the Irish more than they resented the native-born Protestants, because the Irish had dominated the Catholic hierarchy. This was especially a problem for French Canadians, but also for Italians. So there were sort of rivalries within ethnic Catholic working class America as well. And so all of this was going against the Democrats, and Smith managed to really bring a lot of these people together, again, both on cultural and the economic levels.
So when Smith does get the nomination in 1928, and he campaigns for the presidency, what sort of agenda does he specifically advocate, and how does he present this agenda? To whom is he trying to reach out to, and how is he trying to make this argument?
Well, it is a complicated point. So he wants to, he says at his acceptance address in August in Albany, and it's broadcast over the radio, he's going to maintain contact with the American people throughout this campaign. And so it's going to be through a series of speeches, major addresses in major cities all around the country, which are, of course, at that time, reprinted verbatim in almost all the major newspapers around the country, and also broadcast over the radio. And so part of it is just speaking about issues. And what he actually did was he would choose one, two, maybe three major issues to focus on in a given speech. So his first big speech is in Omaha, and he speaks about farm relief, which was a big issue in the 1920s. Farmers were suffering terribly throughout the 20s. There was no roaring 20s if you were a wheat farmer in the upper plains, for example. And so he spoke about that. And so he spoke about that. He spoke about water power. He spoke about the treatment of laborers. He spoke about tariff reform. He spoke about making the federal government more efficient the way he had tried to do it in New York State. And yes, he also spoke about some of the more famous cultural issues. He gave a very courageous and very celebrated speech in Oklahoma City, denouncing the Ku Klux Klan and saying, you know, if somebody calls themselves 100% American, that's ridiculous. There is no such thing as somebody who's 100% American. And he did criticize prohibition and the way that it was being handled. So he did talk about the cultural issues as well. So that was one way that he spread his message. And another way was through constantly referring back to his accomplishments in New York State, both in campaign ads, which appeared in newspapers all over the country. Often in his own speeches, he would reference, well, here's how I handled this sort of thing in New York. And you didn't have to think too far to make analogies to national issues. And the other thing is he had a lot of people speaking on his behalf. His running mate, Joe Robinson, gave a lot of in-depth speeches, especially in the West and to a lesser extent in the South, and focused on issues about labor and farms and so forth. A lot of those progressive social work women that we talked about earlier, a lot of Frances Perkins barnstormed the Northeast giving speeches for Al Smith. Molly Dewson gave a number of speeches. A lot of other people did. Lillian Wald, it's actually sort of funny. In Lillian Wald's case, she and Jane Addams, Jane Addams, another, probably the most famous of the Settlement House women. Jane Addams was actually a Hoover supporter. And so Wald and Jane Addams had a sort of agreement that neither of them would give speeches. But instead, Lillian Wald wrote letters and sent them to dozens and dozens of social workers all over the country, lauding Smith's social welfare record and calling him the person who's done more than any other man in the history of New York to improve the lives of workers and so forth. And so there were a lot of ways of spreading that message, and it really did. It really did take. I'm sure we'll talk about it later. But the idea that the individual voters who were trying to get to know and understand why they vote the way they vote, there's a good bit of evidence that they were actually responsive to that message. And so I'll just say one other thing. This is how he had always operated in New York State. He took some of these issues. For example, we were talking before about administrative reform. That sounds very arcane and technocratic and boring, right? And most voters don't want to hear. But he was able to make it popular and understandable, and that was his political style. He would take these big issues, boil them down into terms that the average voter could understand, but without being condescending about it, and so turn these reforms into people's initiatives. And he took the same approach with, obviously, he wasn't elected, so with less success, but the same approach nationally. And people were starting to respond, as I try to demonstrate in the book.
Because I was thinking as you're describing that, you would think it was difficult to appreciate the impact at first, because when the votes were all counted, it was a landslide for Herbert Hoover in 1928. Not only did the Democrats, lose in the West, and they lost in the Midwest, and Al Smith even lost New York State in the election, but the Republicans even made inroads in the South. They won Virginia, they won Texas, they won Florida. And so on the face of it, it seemed as though that Smith had failed, in the sense of he, for whatever reason you choose, either because he was too New York, because he was Catholic, because of his progressive agenda. And yet, as you explain, that when you parse into these communities in the north, in the Northeast, that there was this almost this catalyzation taking effect among the voters in those areas, that we can perhaps see. We perhaps extrapolate out to happening elsewhere throughout America in the 1920s into the 1930s.
Absolutely, and you really picked up on what I think is the most important point here. And to go back to his losing, there are so many. All the reasons you mentioned are right for why he loses. Right, the fact that he's a Catholic really did hurt him in places like the Upper Midwest, where farmers were suffering, but they still didn't vote to change the status quo. Places like the South, where, as you pointed out, he's the first Democrat ever to lose Texas, the first Democrat since Reconstruction to lose places like Virginia and Florida and so forth. And even the states in the South that he did win, a lot of them were a lot closer than they normally would have been. But in the Northeast, especially, and in urban America, urban industrial America in general, but especially in New England, you see voters. Not only does he win Rhode Island, he's the first Democrat to take a majority. Wilson had gotten a plurality, but he's the first Democrat to get a majority in Rhode Island since Franklin Pierce. So that's a long time. And he wins Massachusetts. He makes things closer in other northeastern states, ironically, including New York, although it wasn't enough to have him win in his home state. And we can talk about why in a moment if you want, but that was a crushing blow to him. But in any case, the voters in those places, especially in industrial communities in the Northeast, they were responsive to his cultural message. They had always felt that they had been ethnically marginalized, religiously marginalized. Both Catholic and Jewish voters felt that way. And so his denunciations of the Klan and of snobbishness and of bigotry really meant a great deal to them. However, that if that got their attention, and it surely did, what they also were hungering for by 1928 is a way to improve their day-to-day lives. And that meant things like the kinds of labor protections he had pursued in New York State, taking those ideas onto a national level. Or it would mean things like housing was pretty ramshackle in a lot of these communities, or infant mortality rates were incredibly high in a lot of these communities. There are a lot of other issues. He had done things to deal with all of those issues in New York State, and he was talking about them again. Unfortunately for us, there wasn't occasion for him to go into a lot of specifics on how these things translated nationally, except that the idea that the approach and the governing philosophy translated nationally had been made clear. A lot of his surrogates were a lot more clear. People like Frances Perkins, people like Mary Norton, a congresswoman from New Jersey who spoke on his behalf, they went into a lot more detail about the things he had done in New York and what might be expected on a national level. And so what happened, in short, is that these workers responded to Smith and formed a new, and it turned out to be a very durable, political coalition responsive to his sort of three-pronged progressive campaign. And the three prongs are pluralism, but also social welfare and labor protections. All three of those things were very meaningful to the voters that ended up becoming Smith Democrats and staying in the Democratic Party moving forward. And that's why, that goes back to the very first question you asked about political history. That's why you have to understand these voters' lives holistically. You can't just say, here's how they voted this year, and look at some numbers and say, oh, they were Catholic, they were this, they were that. You have to try and dig into what their lives were like and see what they themselves were saying, to the extent that those sources are available, and a lot of them you can find in letters to the editor and things like that. And what you find is that, as you said, they really were galvanized as Democrats at that time, and it makes the election, despite the map being sort of overwhelmingly red, it makes the election a lot more important in the long run.
There's an aspect of your argument in your book, though, that it's also important to highlight, which is the fact that you make this argument with a degree of nuance, because you have some historians in the past who have read into Al Smith, 1928, and what he has done as sort of the first draft of the New Deal. And as you point out, that's a bit of an overstatement in that respect. We have to read it in a more cautious light in that respect. But it's one that I thought was a very interesting point to make, because it gives a sense of proportion, in effect, that Al Smith's not doing this with an anticipation of what's going to be needed during the New Deal, although Franklin Roosevelt does give him due credit for pioneering a lot of the things that he would then take and run with when he becomes president in 1933.
Yeah, it's exactly right. There's a tendency to do one of two things with Al Smith. Either look at the fact that he had been pursuing social welfare initiatives in New York State and labor reforms in New York State, and then look later on that his 1920s era ally FDR is doing those things at a national level and say, oh, well, you see, he's the father of the New Deal. And that really is going too far. What Smith was doing in New York was in the context of the problems that New York was facing. This is what a good governor is trying to do. He's trying to deal with his society's problems. He wasn't facing the Great Depression. But what he was facing, both in New York State and nationally, and this is why, you know, when we talk about life in industrial New England or in other communities, what he was facing was a lot of people who were suffering in the meantime. And so it might not have been these sort of sweeping calls for the kind of reforms we see in the New Deal, but it was responding to the kinds of problems that were going to become even more gargantuan in scale and even more troubling for even more people once the Depression hit and once FDR had to deal with them in the New Deal era. And so there are things that are, in one historian's words, akin to what would happen in the New Deal. But the other pole is there are a lot of historians who look at what Al Smith is doing and they call him a conservative in the 1920s. And I think they're reading it backwards through the prism of the New Deal. And they're saying, well, since it's not New Deal liberalism, it must be sort of conservative. And that's expecting too much. I mean, in the 1920s, despite everything that I point out in the book about the communities that did vote for Smith, there was a general feeling, we now know they were wrong, but there was a general feeling that the economy was working and that this was a time of Hoover prosperity. And so for a mainstream political candidate, to expect them to be sort of calling for this fundamental overhaul of the political economy, that seems a little bit ahistorical as well. So the word nuance that you use is exactly right. You have to understand these things in their own context. You have to understand that world of the voters, of the politicians, in all of its nuance and all of its complexity, and then you can understand what was going on and how it did indeed help set in motion some of the political coalitions and dynamics that would help fuel and shape the New Deal once the New Deal was happening. But I agree with you that it's important to point out that I'm not, as others have, saying Al Smith gave us the New Deal, because I think that's way too far.
I was thinking also about how how Smith himself ends up, you know, complicating that argument, given how he, you know, by the early 1930s, he becomes associated with the Liberty League. He starts to denounce Franklin Roosevelt, and he really seems to be at pains to, you know, in effect, feed into that argument some of those more those historians you point out who, you know, play up the idea of Smith as conservative, because Smith, if he is a father of the New Deal, certainly wants to disown his child.
That's a good way of putting it. It makes things. I mean, it makes it a little tricky. What I often tell people, irrespective of one's own political leanings, if you read this story, it does have kind of a sad ending. And the point is that I believe, and I think I should demonstrate in the book, that by that time, by 1934-35, when he's with the Liberty League giving some of these speeches, when he's voting Republican in 1936, he has changed. There are those who say, well, he was always conservative. This is consistent with his earlier career. That just doesn't hold up in the face of the analysis of his time as governor. It doesn't hold up when you consider some of the things he pushed for as governor and even as a presidential nominee. He's not as aggressive as a presidential nominee because the nature of the Constitution does, in his view and a lot of people, doesn't necessarily allow that, certainly in the 1920s, and nor do economic conditions. But it is clear, once you've gone through the whole story that I lay out, he has clearly changed in the 1930s when he is giving these Liberty League speeches. And in fact, it's a sort of sad, ironic moment. He gives a speech with the Liberty League denouncing FDR's programs as communistic, and the next day Harold Ickes was able to quote an Al Smith speech from 1928 to repudiate what Al Smith had said in the 1930s, and it does sort of demonstrate how much he had changed. And I think what's even more significant, because it's not a Smith biography, and I should point that out. I mean, he's the central character, obviously, but it's not a biography of Al Smith. What's even more significant about that change is that all of those voters who came into the Democratic Party because of Al Smith in 1928, they didn't then leave the Democratic Party because of him joining the Liberty League or him supporting Alf Landon in 36. They became even more Democratic as the New Deal went on, because the New Deal on the federal level was expressing it was responding to the kinds of needs that they had expressed by supporting Smith back in 28. And so they became even more Democratic rather than less, despite what Smith had done. So the sad thing is that even though he was, if not a father of the New Deal, he's certainly a father of the New Deal coalition, the coalition went on without him.
Well, we've taken up a lot of your time, but before we go, could you tell us what you're working on now?
Oh, absolutely. In some ways, it's kind of a, I guess you could say it's sort of a thematic sequel to the Revolution of 28. My current book is about a congresswoman from New Jersey. I mentioned her a moment ago, Mary Teresa Norton. It covers a lot of the same themes as the Revolution of 28, the intersection of class and labor and ethnicity. It also focuses a lot more on questions of gender. Mary Norton was, like Smith, Irish Catholic machine politician. Instead of being from Tammany, she was from the, if there's any machine even more notorious than Tammany, it might be in Jersey City with the Hague machine. And so she's part of that operation. But she was a daughter of Irish immigrants. What's interesting about Norton is, unlike a lot of the women we were talking about earlier who became progressive reformers and went into the working class cities to help people out of very humane inclinations, Mary Teresa Norton came from within that world. She was a daughter of working class immigrants. She lost her only child as an infant and went into social work sort of to pull herself out of the depression she went into. And through that social work, she then became associated with city government and with the Hague machine, and by 1924 she was elected to Congress. The reason I think she's so fascinating is, number one, she pushes a lot of the same agenda I talk about with Smith in Congress, and she's there throughout the New Deals and into the 40s and through the 40s, and she was the chair of the House Labor Committee when they got the Fair Labor Standards Act passed in 1938, and she was fundamentally important to even getting that to a vote, let alone passed. And so she gives us a lot of insight into the development of sort of mid-20th century American liberalism in the aftermath of Smith's loss in 28. And so that's I'm, as you can probably tell, I'm knee-deep in that project now. I've done a little bit of writing, and so hopefully it won't be too many years before people can have a look at that as well.
Well, I hope when it does come out, we have an opportunity to bring you back to feature the book in a future podcast.
So that would be great.
Rob Childs, thank you very much for taking some time out of your schedule to speak with us. I hope you have a wonderful day.
Thanks. You too.